I am Elliot Robert Claw. I'm a retired internist, and I practiced here from 2002 to about 2015 or 16. And I stopped working primarily because of chronic neck and back issues. I've had a lot of back surgery, a lot of neck surgery.
So you retired for health reasons. Is that
primarily,
true?
Although I also had become completely disturbed and upset by the direction that healthcare delivery had taken in the county. My partners voted to allow to take over the practice, and they did. And by way of anecdote, they changed the plumbing in the offices, even though the plumbing was completely functional. And I went home, and my wife's a very unusual lady. She's an Israeli kibbutznik and just has high school. Went on, became a professional pattern maker, but she's really one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I said to her, they changed the plumbing in the office, and I can make no sense out of it. And she said, it's because they're going to characterize it as a hospital and double the rates. And I said, that's ridiculous. And they did.
So you are a doctor, and so tell me about this disillusionment. Where do we start? Tell me about what you think about the healthcare system.
Well,
right now.
I tell you what, I'll give you a very brief thumbnail of where I've been and what I've done, which I think affords me a pretty unique perspective. I grew up in New York City. I went through the public and free school system from kindergarten through medical school. I went to a high school for gifted kids, a place called Bronx Science, which was free and was considered the best high school in the United States at that time. I went to City College at a time when it was considered a very good institution. And I went to medical school in Buffalo, the SUNY system, New York State system. And then I trained in the municipal hospital system. The medical school that I worked with was Flower Fifth Avenue, New York Medical College. They changed the name, and they ran in association with the Health and Hospital Corporation of New York. They contracted to run a large municipal hospital in Spanish Harlem. So I did my training there. I left briefly, worked at a place called Montefiore. It's a huge hospital up in the Bronx. And directed their ICU, and then I got a call to go back to Metropolitan Hospital and run their ICU, which I did for about 6.5 years. I also was the assistant chief of medicine at that hospital. I ran their physical diagnosis course and supervised the residency program in internal medicine. I joined an HMO and practiced half-time there and half-time at Met until financial pressures of a divorce forced me to earn a living. I then worked at Lenox Hill Hospital for about 6 more years, started a private practice in New York, and I was on staff at Lenox Hill Doctors Hospital and a hospital, New York Hospital, although I never admitted anyone to New York Hospital. I had just about enough of working a million hours a week at that time, and I opted to sell my practice and take my wife and my little girl and spend a year traveling, which we did. Spent about 6 months in Europe, 6 months in Israel, came back, looked for a place to start working, wound up in Colorado, and worked in a little town called Crested Butte for about 10 years. My wife's health was problematic at altitude, and we wound up looking for a sea level location and wound up here. So I've worked in a municipal hospital setting, a private hospital setting, a teaching setting, community hospital setting, small private practice setting in Colorado, private hospital setting here. I think I've pretty much done everything that you can do as an internist in the United States. And I would have to say that I got a tremendous kick out of my time working here. I like the community, like the people. I had a pretty broad range of patients who I say they're a good group to take care of. And I think I got pretty much nothing but positive feedback from my patients. Several years before I retired, my partners opted to stop doing hospital work, which Bob Brenman, who you may know his name or may not, another internist, a wonderful internist, he and I both refused to stop doing night call, not because we enjoyed working at night or we enjoyed hospital work per se, but that it allowed us to do more than make diagnoses, allowed us to deliver care.
Okay. What does that mean at night hospital? I don't know what that means.
Okay. In other words, they opted to stop admitting their patients to the hospital and taking care of them. They opted to let the hospitalists, full-time in-hospital internists, do all the hospital work, and they would themselves only do office-based work.
Okay.
And that's not the traditional role, hadn't been the traditional role of internists. Typically, an internist would see you in the office, take care of you if you got sick, put you in the hospital, and then supervise your care in the hospital. And if you needed subspecialist care, that you would have that supervised by me as your doctor. And then my cohort of physicians here opted to stop doing that, which meant that they no longer delivered care in a hospital setting. They just did office-based medicine, sent people off to another doctor in the hospital. And about a year and a half after that, they confronted with the uncertainties of healthcare in the United States from a physician's point of view, opted to give the practice to in exchange for a guaranteed salary that was the same as what they were making before.
I see. And why did they make the initial decision not to do hospital work?
It's a lot of work.
Okay.
It involves getting up. If you get your call at 2 a.m, you have to go and go to work at 2 a.m. If you do hospital work, you're obliged to do rounds on the weekend as well. So they opted to go from a 6 or 7 day a week practice to a 5 day in-office practice, which is easier, but involved a much reduced spectrum of care delivery than they would have done otherwise.
Okay.
And then they, as I say, handed the practice to, which I don't really want to characterize as evil, but as very typical of corporate healthcare delivery in America. And that's really that seems to me that's the crux of the problem.
Okay, so when you started in the medical field, it was not like that, I take. It was different.
When I started in the medical field, I worked exclusively in a city hospital, which delivered care to free care to poor people. And that was the only medicine interface that I had other than 6 months at Montefiore in a private hospital setting, which was completely different. I mean, and all the money you needed or wanted for delivering care, every subspecialist, every option for procedure or whatever immediately, as opposed to a city hospital system where I would have to either beg, whine, or threaten a subspecialist to deliver care. And then on to private practice, and then off into the rest of my tour through the healthcare system. And what I perceive of now is that healthcare in the United States has become so fragmented and so complicated that it's reached a level of inefficiency that's literally hard to believe. And some of the statistics are equally hard to believe. We pay in the United States twice as much as the Europeans pay for half the care, literally. So we pay, well, in terms of what our GNP is, we pay about 18% of our gross national product now for healthcare. And child mortality in the United States is in the about the 30th worst in the world.
Wow.
Taiwan pays 6% of their GNP for healthcare, and it's completely nationalized. And there is no really simple solution for how one should deliver healthcare, but there's some things that are so striking to me now.
So I was going to ask you, like, how did we get here to this quagmire, and how do we get out? How do we fix it? How patients like me, I don't like it either.
And your health insurance, the problem is that even if you've got, quotes, good health insurance these days, the costs are so extraordinary for people who buy their own. I was just speaking to a friend who's a building contractor in Half Moon Bay, $1,500 a month for his family health care. And he just had to close his business out because some guy whose house he built and put about $150,000 of his own money into refused to pay.
My goodness.
Bankrupted him. So he's working two jobs now and paying for health care for himself, his wife, and his kid. How did we get there? We got there because before Medicare, doctors worked on a fee-for-service basis in the United States, and health care was affordable. You went to your doctor. When I was a kid, it was $5 to go to your doctor, and you went to your doctor if you needed stitches or you had measles or you had appendicitis. The same person would deliver that care, knew you, knew your family, and wasn't interested in becoming wealthy. He was wanted to be a doctor. Corporate America shows what I would describe as a brilliance in profiteering. I mean, they're geniuses at making money. And when it became clear over time that the amount of money to be made in healthcare was unlimited because you could not only tap the public directly but the government as well as an income source, corporate America realized it's time to get the show on the road, and they have with vigor. So what was originally an attempt to deliver health care to the elderly, Medicare, which I would say in general is a very successful program in the United States, has been co-opted in a million different ways by third-party payers who have proliferated to the degree that you can't even name them all. And you can't even name the variations on the theme. I mean, there's Medicare, Medicare Plus, there's Medicare this, there's Medicare that. There are a variety of programs administered by third parties that deliver Medicare and supervise it and are paid by the Fed. There are accountable care organizations that are paid directly by the Fed. There are private doctors that are paid by the Fed, and on and on. And I think the harbinger of doom was when I was practicing in New York and Medicare said that if you wish to be paid, you had to submit electronic billing. And the upshot of that was we went from a situation where you had an office with three people besides a doctor to an office with 20 people because you needed five or six or eight people who did nothing but bill, code and bill. So this attempt to render more transparent the nature of healthcare and render third-party reimbursements more simple became a nightmare, which we've not recovered from. Even though electronic medical records are mandated across the United States, no two systems has the same electronic medical record. So you can have a complete and accurate transcript of your health care at point A, and if you wind up at point B, it's inaccessible. You can go to the emergency room because you think you're dying from some abdominal event and then have your insurance company refuse to pay because they think your symptoms didn't warrant a visit. You can be seen in the operating room having a surgery that you scheduled and had approved by your insurance and have a visiting doctor, visiting surgeon, pop in, do whatever they do, and then bill you $10,000 outside your insurance coverage. You can become catastrophically ill and find that your insurance is unwilling to pick it up. I was stunned to read that half of all bankruptcies in the United States are on the basis of medical bills. So we're in a morass of health care. And yet at the same time, Madison Avenue and big pharma and big hospitals managed to deliver to the average American the delusion that medicine can cure literally anything. And whatever you have, it can be made better pharmaceutically. And they have medicalized a number of things which weren't diseases when I was a kid. You like don't what? Have insomnia anymore. You have sleep disorder. You're not anxious. You have social phobia. You don't have a hyperactive kid. You have ADD or ADHD to the point where, and I was stunned by this, I think the number is 10% of kids or 15% of kids are on meds chronically now. If you ask your peers here in SLO, I would say that two out of every three people are on antidepressants, literally. And what's even more stunning and amazing is that if you scrutinize the studies of efficacy, there aren't any.
There aren't any.
They don't exist because the pharma, big pharma, is such a powerful force that what they've done is they have suppress studies that are negative or equivocal, and they have financed studies that are positive to show the effect of their medications.
And there's no one an independent agency doing studies?
FDA does less and less every year with less and less money.
Right. What about the National Institute of Health, aren't they?
The NIH funding is also diminished progressively over time. And many of the studies the FDA does are in concert with the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes.
Again, the dollar amounts involved are so striking. We have a therapy for hepatitis C, which is a scourge in the United States. It's the commonest cause of liver failure in the United States. And we have a medication that can be administered simply and safely and 95% effectively for $50,000 a shot.
Wow.
We have cancer chemotherapies that will prolong your life 2 or 3 months and are offered for $100,000 a year.
Wow.
The FDA, which does, quotes, non-inferiority studies, in other words, they'll demonstrate that a new drug is at least as good as existing drugs, never does comparator studies. In other words, you could treat your rheumatoid arthritis with a combination of an old chemotherapeutic agent and a sulfa-based drug, and its efficacy is very similar to the biologic agents that are out now for $50,000 or $60,000 a year.
I see.
Because no one ever does comparator studies to say, okay, the new med works. It works as well as the old meds. Is it any better? And again, the cost considerations.
Right, okay.
So we're stuck societally, it seems to me, in a situation where we can't afford health care anymore. And I think that has to change. And there is a pretty straightforward way to change it.
What can we do?
Well, I think, first of all, the majority of Americans now favor a single-payer system. There was a time everyone was screaming socialism, communism. And everyone was horrified, and death panels were being set up to kill the elderly, and the Democrats were conspiring to limit health care and so on and so forth. But now the majority of Americans feel that a single-payer system would help them, and it's a simple concept.
Yes, tell me, because I never really understood what it meant.
It's really straightforward. It's Medicare for all. Medicare-E, Medicare for everybody.
Okay, I don't have Medicare, so what does it even, tell me
well,
what it means.
I do, I'm 72, okay. I'll be 73 shortly. What it means is that after you're 66, that 80%+ of your health care is covered by the Fed.
Oh, okay.
Period, flat out. And if you buy another insurance, a secondary insurance, which I pay some $500 a month for, it pays the balance. So it means that for $500 a month, I am completely covered from a healthcare purview, whereas you, a working young woman, you ain't.
No. I have.
And you have the risk, if you had a serious illness, you could be bankrupted.
And so how do we get to the single payer? I mean, I know I've reported in the last year there was an effort to make universal health care in California, just in California, and the numbers came out and everyone's like, it's going to cost $4 billion, and everyone freaked and it went nowhere. So,
See, this is part of the incredible power of propaganda. All these studies are done. The stuff you asked about health, how do you analyze health care? How is it done? Harvard has a global health program. Their estimates are that the healthcare dollar, 50 cents of your healthcare dollar, goes to administrative costs. So if you simplified the administrative costs of healthcare delivery, in other words, have the Fed simply pay a fixed amount for office visits, which obviously you could stratify. You know, Trump's comment is I'd have 2 pay scales for office visits, simple and complicated, would have you basically equating people getting cancer chemotherapy with somebody with an itchy rectum, which maybe makes sense to Trump, but very few other people. But you could certainly have a fee schedule that was simple or straightforward, or even a salary for physicians that was equitable, and you would eliminate a lot of the chaos in the system. See, we have a setup now. If you were a factory worker in England and you were being paid piecemeal for work, It's very straightforward. You try to make as many widgets as you can during the day because that's how you get paid. Doctors, sadly, are like every other human being in the world and to some degree are involved in self-interest. So they like to make as many widgets in a day as they can or create ways to make more expensive widgets. And a good deal of our health care, unfortunately, is devoted to that. It's procedures that are iffy, medications that are unproven, and diagnostic maneuvers that offer no real value but offer the buzzword of laser, robot, computer, which everyone's madly in love with. Another example might be, not to get too far off track, robotic surgery has been pushed by a company called Da Vinci, which makes a robot for surgery.
Right.
And for a good while, men with their prostate cancers, which frankly most men wind up with at some point or another, were having robotic surgery via Da Vinci robot, which is $1 million a pop.
Wow.
No advantage outcome-wise to manual surgical procedures. Zero. But it was robotic.
Right.
People go to Florida and have laser back surgery, which offers no advantage over traditional back surgery, but it has the word laser in it. So big business has so monetized healthcare delivery in so many different ways that people are really completely confused about the nature of healthcare, what's reasonable, what's not reasonable, what you should do, what you shouldn't do. We all have colonoscopies. The data to show that colonoscopy is in any way superior to a simple sigmoidoscopy doesn't exist.
Hmm.
Studies have never been done, but everybody goes and does them. If we had the Fed do for the general population what Medicare does for the elderly, and which, by the way, our government does for every single member of the Senate and the House of Representatives for free forever,
right?
They have global health care. No copay forever.
Wow.
Now, why is that? Why would somebody who we elect have the option of having a better caliber health care than you do or I do? I mean, you pay your taxes, right?
Right. I don't know. I don't like that.
I don't like it either. And it's just part of a way of profiteering. See, health care delivery, as it's presented, is the delivery of healthcare, but in point of fact, it's not. It's the business of delivering healthcare. So I guess part of why I called to come in has to do with my daughter, who is now finishing medical school. And aside from being gorgeous and pregnant, she is a girl who did art history, finished that up at Berkeley, spent a year in Italy, went back, spent another 6 months in Italy at the museums, and found that it really wasn't intellectually satisfying, that the art was, but interacting with the people who ran the museums and the artists was insupportable. Their egos were beyond belief. Went off to medical school, incurred a pretty significant debt, and is opted to become a pediatrician, which is the lowest paid medical specialty in the United States. And I asked her why she picked peds, and she said, I really love the kids, and I can talk to them. And they are a group that can hear. They're a group that can be informed, and that whatever you do with a child has a lifelong impact.
Okay.
And it's not profiteering. She's doing it because she wants to be a good person. She wants to feel like her life has some meaning and substance. And I think that the majority of doctors in the United States at the bottom have that same urge. They want to do right by their patients. But they also were caught up in the crap of corporatization of healthcare. They're fearful. They don't know where things will be down the road, whether they'll be paid, how much they'll be paid. And if you leave medical school owing $400,000 or $500,000, the impetus to make a lot of money is pretty powerful. What's the answer?
What's the answer?
The answer is for each of us to impose on our politicians our need for affordable health care, which is not inventing the wheel, since the overwhelming majority of first world countries around the world have already delivered healthcare in a far more efficient way than we have. And there's every conceivable construct out there. Many countries have, quotes, privatized healthcare, but it's carefully scrutinized by the government, very carefully. Prices are regulated, and the interaction between the people who deliver healthcare and the people who manufacture drugs and the people who run hospitals is very carefully controlled so they don't engage in mutual profiteering, which is part of the dance that we have now. I had a patient who had didn't have insurance, wanted a urine culture. It was a young woman who'd had recurrent bladder infections. I sent in a urine culture and charged her $500 for urine culture.
Wow.
And I called the lab and I said, how is that even remotely possible? Well, so your patient's uninsured. They charge what they like. So the simple answer is we each of us have to militate for affordable health care because I think it's a critical – I mean, it's as critical as having a place to live and having an adequate diet. And I think also Americans have to wake up and realize that the answer to relative good health has much more to do with what you eat, what you don't ingest, whether it's alcohol or tobacco, how often you exercise, and whether you can find some meaning in your life. I mean, those are things that have some substance, and I think for some reason we're all off base with that. We're looking for quick fixes for everything, a pill for everything, you know? Why should I resolve my existential anxiety about having a meaningless job and an unhappy marriage when I can take medication for it, as opposed to trying to make sense?
Right. And to go back to your point of to people kind of rising up and demanding health care, well, Big Pharma and all the you know, all those companies will just launch a campaign and
I don't think you can afford that attitude because if you think back to Vietnam, we were up to our hips in a futile and murderous war serving no obvious purpose there other than perhaps the preservation of rubber and oil assets in that part of the world and the power base that existed. And that would have gone on forever. In fact, Nixon, you know, we now know, conspired to prolong that war for another year or two in order for him to maintain his office. And yet the fact that Americans finally stood up and said, no, we will not participate in this, finally moved the government. And I think that Indivisible, the political movement for the Democrats, has had its impact. And I think that it's always tempting to say, well, you know, we can't really do anything because they control the media and they have an infinite budget and they'll do whatever they want. I think left alone, our healthcare system is going to implode in the next 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
It'll just literally explode. And it would be nice to do something about it before it becomes completely chaotic.
Okay.
It's crazy to lose your home because you can't pay your medical bills. And my personal feeling is that we owe every citizen of the United States basic health care. I think that's my take on the Constitution. It talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all of which are impossible if you can't obtain routine and adequate health care.
Indeed.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this.
My pleasure.